Appointments online at homeadvisor.com.
Support for WMNF comes from our members and the Straz Center, presenting the Broadway musical Fun Home, based on Alice Bechdel's graphic memoir, Fun Home. This musical takes a look at one parent's lives through grown-up eyes. That's November 28th through December 3rd. More information at strazcenter.org. Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up today, we're going to hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV. Then we'll open up the phone lines in the later part of the program and talk about some of the issues that came up on the show that need to be updated. We'll do the update right after the show. And then we'll talk about some of the other issues in the news in the last 24 hours. But stick around for Florida This Week right here on WMNF 88.5 FM. Coming up next, St. Petersburg residents will select their next mayor on Tuesday. Private investigators are secretly following state legislators looking for scandal. There may be problems with that proposed new baseball stadium site in Tampa. And a wealthy multimillionaire jumps into the Democratic race for governor. Political Insights next on Florida This Week.
WEDU Studios, this is Florida This Week. And now, moderator Rob Lori.
Welcome back. This week our panelists are April Schiff is a political consultant and a Republican. William Arch is a longtime political reporter. Mike Deason is an independent investigative journalist. And Susan McGrath is chair of the Pinellas County Democratic Party. Well, it's great to have you all here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Well, the razor-thin race for mayor of St. Petersburg will be decided this coming Tuesday between incumbent Rick Kreisman and former Mayor Rick Baker. Kreisman, a Democrat, has been dogged by questions about his handling of the city's sewage system. A new investigation from the Florida Wildlife Commission found that hundreds of millions of gallons of partially treated and untreated sewage were spilled into neighborhoods, waterways, or pumped underground during a 13-month period. The commission found that 89 felonies and 103 misdemeanors were committed as the city released the sewage. But the report does not name who committed those felonies and points out the crisis has been brewing because of the city's inattention to its infrastructure over the last 20 years. Kreisman and his supporters have tagged his Republican opponent, Baker, as being an ally of Donald Trump and in denial about global warming. So, Mike, with just a few days left, how would you handicap this? Does either candidate have a leg up?
Well, it looks like right now Kreisman may have a leg up, but that report last week was an indictment of the Kreisman administration and the sewage crisis. Now, it is a problem that's gone on for 20 years, but 101 of those misdemeanors and all 89 of those felonies fall flatly on the Kreisman administration. And that is an issue that has dominated his administration for the entire time that he's been there.
But the state attorney, Bernie McCabe, says he's not going to file charges. He says there's nobody to file charges against.
I talked to Bernie, I guess, last week, a week ago on Friday, and he said that's the problem. Who does he charge? And even if he wins, he said it's like kissing your sister. You're going to get money from the state going back in. But still in all, it falls on the Kreisman administration, which has handled that in a horrible way, with a lack of transparency, with lying. The mayor lied to my face when there was raw sewage going into Clam Bayou and said it wasn't happening, even though his public works director, standing as close to me as Susan is right here, said, yes, it is happening. They have not handled it well. If it was just on that issue, I think that Baker would win, but there's a broader issue for the voters
to deal
with.
Well, Susan, that's the big question. I mean, it seems to me the voters in St. Petersburg are really split, that most have made up their mind, and you're only, you as the one of the Democrats who's trying to get out the Kreisman vote,
right,
you're only going after 2% of the vote that may be undecided right now. Is that right?
Right. So the sewage issue has been politicized by Pinellas Republicans and Florida Republicans and the Baker campaign the entire time. They're using that issue to try and hang something around the mayor's neck when even the survey points out it's been going on for 20 years. So 20 years points back to which administration, right? So now it comes to Election Day, and you're right. Is there anybody out there that's undecided? Probably not, right? People have already voted in this election. It's going to be about getting out the vote. Who can do a better job of getting out their voters? And what we saw in the primary is that Democrats voted in a total of 51.5% was Democratic turnout. That's higher than any election in years, even including the 2012 presidential election.
What do you think motivates the high? Did the Republicans have a similar high turnout in St. Petersburg?
No, Democratic turnout exceeded.
So what motivated the Democrats to come out?
Well, obviously, it's an issue that's unusual. Usually, municipal elections have low turnout, but this resonates with voters where they live, right? It's not the sewer. It comes down to, is St. Petersburg a better city today than it was 9 or 10 years ago, right? And people care about those issues, and people see what's happening in the city of St. Petersburg.
Susan, wait a second. First of all, you can't say FWC. The workers that put that report together are political appointees. They are long-term workers who have put the blame on the Christman administration. And when you have raw sewage in your streets, that is something that affects the voters and the people. I think that Rick Christman reminds me of Jimmy Carter. He has good moral values and lofty ideas, but he hasn't been able to pull it off. And that's where I think he's fallen short in it. And I think that sewage is a main issue. It does go back for decades, but he didn't handle it well when things exacerbated. And even the report said he lied. The administration lied about saying it's a 100-year storm. It's an unusual event. They have no transparency and can't tell the truth.
So the FWC is an agency that reports that falls under Rick Scott's purvey, right?
Well, no, not the workers. Not the workers. The, right. Yeah, the head of the agency, but the people right. who do the interviews and go out and make those reports right. are not politicized.
But the actual agency falls under, and the timing of the release, the commission had the report for over a year and released it right before the election, right? So we all know nothing is an accident in politics, right? So yes, it's been a subject of conversation amongst Republicans for years.
I find it very interesting that you say that the Democratic vote was so huge in the turnout and yet Christman only won by 69 votes over Baker during that. So I'm not sure that all those Democrats that came out were actually voting for Christman. I think you see a lot of crossover, particularly in municipal nonpartisan elections. You will see that, though this one, like all of them, are becoming these days much, much more politicized and much more partisan. And you're seeing a lot more nationalization, which the Christman's been throwing Trump at Baker throughout the entire campaign.
But do you think that might be a smart strategy, though? I mean, given, you know, if President Trump has high negatives yeah. and you're in a Democratic city, tying Baker to Trump may be a good strategy.
Sure, but we're seeing it across the board in more municipal elections where they're pulling in national issues and national figures and also becoming more and more partisan in these nonpartisan mm-hmm. municipal
because
elections.
Because people care about that. That's why it works. If it didn't work, people wouldn't be talking about it. But issues such as the conversation around Donald Trump, people care about that. It's important to them, and that's why people have that conversation.
Wendy, one other big issue is turnout, and one of the most important groups in St. Pete is the African-American vote. And Baker certainly has a lot of fans in the African-American community, as does Christman.
Well, April made a good point. Rick Baker won Midtown, the Midtown precincts in the first round. That's the inner city, largely black area, which raises the question. Democrats have done an excellent job of voter turnout in this election, but when they turn those voters out, who are they voting for? Not all of them may be voting for Christman. Mm-hmm. Some may be voting for Baker. I think there's no question, though, that at a statewide level, the involvement of both parties suggests that everybody is taking this as a test of the Trump versus anti-Trump sentiment in the state. If Christman wins, Democrats will say it proves that Trump is hated and unpopular. If Baker wins, Republicans will say it proves that there is no real anti-Trump resistance movement. I also think that it is clear that nationalizing the race has helped Baker some, has helped Kreisman some. That's probably what pulled him out of the primary. Some, incrementally maybe, no more than incrementally, but at least some.
This is going to be one of the most expensive races, the most expensive race in city history for mayor. Mike, I want to go back to one more issue that's come up, the police chief. It looks like Kreisman wants to keep the current chief. Baker is saying, I'm not going to make up my mind until I get an office.
Baker wants him to live in the city. And I mean, there have been problems in Tampa where some chief executives of the city didn't live in the city. It's in the city charter for Tampa. It's not for St. Pete. He, I believe, likes the police chief, but believes if you're going to be the police chief of a city, it makes sense to live in that city, and I think that's where the hang-up is there.
Except that crime numbers are better under the Kreisman administration than they were under the Baker administration. So regardless of where the chief lives, let's base it on results, right? And the results are improving for crime and recidivism and arrest, especially for people of color and young men in the city of St. Petersburg.
But nationally, so are the stats of that. It reflects the national trend of a downward spiral in crime as well.
But there's plenty of communities where that's not a fact.
All right.
So it's based on results.
Well, we're going to find out Tuesday.
Well,
Politico is reporting that private investigators have been following state legislators, including GOP gubernatorial candidate Senator Jack Latvala, secretly recording their daily lives in search of scandal.
The website was given private eye photos of the Republican in the company of a female lobbyist and, in one instance, kissing her. Latvala and the lobbyist both have denied any wrongdoing. Politico reports Latvala has been under surveillance for 2 years. The news broke as incoming Senate Democratic leader Jeff Clemons of Lake Worth abruptly resigned last Friday after admitting to an affair with a lobbyist. Among the questions, who is paying for the surveillance and is it political payback?
Well, April, let's start there. Is there any indication who might be behind this surveillance?
Obviously, it's political, okay? So everybody in politics, I don't care who you are, has enemies and people that want to find dirt on them. I think a lot of this is, it's definitely fueled by the available money in the committees. It's probably spurned quite a bit by many political consultants. I don't think using investigators is anything new. I think that's been done for a long, long time. But the newer technologies and the ability to get videos a lot easier, it used to be you would know it if someone was filming you. That's not the case anymore. So I think that it's hard to say exactly who's doing this. I think we're going to see a lot more of it. We're also going to see the results of a lot more of it. So,
do we have any indication whether Clemens' resignation was tied to some sort of surveillance?
There's talk that at some point that it was tied to the Artiles resignation, which had
after making a racist comment.
Yeah. And that was in a bar somewhere, and that there was retaliation because of that, which led to this. But that's all rumor and speculation, and no way to really tell.
I've heard stories for years. Legislators go up to Tallahassee, away from home, for 3 months or 2 months, and they get involved with lobbyists. We hear a lot of stories about hanky-panky up there in Tallahassee.
Right. It's just not that uncommon. And I mean, it probably contributes to it that for years, lobbying firms have purposely hired attractive women to work the male legislators. Legislators having affairs with lobbyists and with each other is not uncommon, but people have always kept quiet about it for one good reason: what goes around tends to come around. Now those rules are breaking down. April is right. There's talk that this is, that the revealing of the Clemens affair had to do with Artiles' loss. In the new round, a camera found in a condo complex where a lot of legislators live, including Oscar Brennan, a Democratic senator. Brennan believes it was placed there, and he thinks it may have been done at Artiles' request because he was one of the moving forces in forcing Artiles to resign over the slurs. Latvala has no idea what's behind his, but it's cannot be unrelated to the fact that he's about to run as the only moderate in a crowd of very conservative Republicans in a primary for governor.
And it's endemic in capital cities. More than 40 years ago, I covered the General Assembly in Richmond. Same thing went on, as April said, the technology wasn't around. But they were away for 3 months, away from their families, and it's just human nature. And legislators who, all of a sudden, the power sometimes goes to their head and think that they are above anybody finding out of them doing anything wrong, oftentimes step outside the moral boundaries of what they should be doing.
But Susan, I'm wondering if we're in a different era now, that people as judgmental as they might have been 30 or 40 years ago if they know that their representative is having an affair. And, you know, and I don't want to pick on President Trump, but, you know, he had an interesting life prior to his third marriage. And
he had an interesting life during his third marriage, right? Gosh, we don't know. There could be a lot of speculation. Is the speaker, you know, does he have something to gain by damaging video or images of Jack Latvala? We don't know. But will people be affected? There's probably going to be some kind of repercussions, right?
So we're not in a new era where people are just more accepting of legislators or members of Congress or politicians having affairs.
I think that people still have a very solid moral grounding and that they don't accept well extramarital kind of affairs and things of that nature, particularly in the environment of power over subordinates, and that's what you see here. It's a give and take kind
of
thing,
or
get what you get.
This is sort of the Harvey Weinstein effect,
and that everybody is becoming more and more aware of is extremely inappropriate and unacceptable. And I think that's across the board. We're going to see more of that. However, what we're seeing now is that these types of incidents are more public than they ever were. I mean, think back to the Kennedy administration even. None of that would ever have been published, though he definitely was having a great time. So in this day and age, because of the 24/7 news, the internet, the technology, you're gonna get that information out, but I don't think that changes people's moral compass.
You mentioned all the things that changed that ad, and one other factor, it's Watergate. As
yes.
you mentioned,
yes.
before Kennedy, everybody got along with the politicians. Yep. Whatever they said, they believed them. And then Watergate came along, and all of a sudden, it was look at them, what they're doing to our country and to everybody else. And you factor in Watergate, the 24 news cycle,
right.
the internet. And that's why now this takes on a higher profile than in the past.
All right. Well, I think April also made a very good point. It's the money. There are huge amounts of money flowing into politics now.
So now you can afford to hire lots of private investigators.
And right. It's also the bitterness and the divisiveness. It's like the Sean Connery line. He puts one of yours in the hospital, you put one of his in the morgue.
Yeah. All right. Well, since a proposed site for a new baseball stadium in Hillsborough County was announced last week, there's been a lot of discussion about the site's drawbacks.
There's no guarantee that the Rays will move from St. Petersburg to Tampa, but if they do, the proposed site is on a very small plot of land, 14 acres in southwest Ybor City. The big questions are, where would fans park? Because there's no land for a giant parking lot. It's also near Malfunction Junction, where I-275 meets I-4. The junction is already a crowded mess during afternoon rush hour, and neither highway has a nearby exit to the site. So the 30,000 hoped-for game fans would have to snake through already crowded streets in Ybor or downtown Tampa, or they would have to rely on a yet non-existent mass transit system, a system that few on the Hillsborough County Commission are willing to support.
And Wendy, there is already a trolley at that site, but do the parking problems and the access to the area make this a very difficult site for a baseball stadium?
They do indeed make it a difficult site, and what's going to have to happen, I think, for this stadium to be a success, if it's ever built, is Tampa's going to have to take a step toward becoming a real big city where people move around downtown on foot and using mass transit. And that's probably what this stadium will depend on. It's not going to be what you have now, where you have a stadium sitting in the midst of vast expanses of parking lots. The big advantage to this site is it's close to Ybor, it's close to downtown and Channelside. You party before the game, then you take mass transit to the game, you party after the game, You take a Uber or something, maybe you left your car in a parking deck or at a collection point where you rode a trolley to the stadium. All of this, of course, is overlooking the big question, $600 million.
The cost. How to pay for it?
Where's that going to come from? I mean, if you know, if that's, if anything, a bigger question than what the one we're discussing.
Okay. Well, Miami Beach Mayor Phil Levine, a self-made multi-millionaire businessman, is getting into the race for governor as a Democrat.
He brings with him the ability to spend millions of his own money in pursuit of the state's top job. The other announced Democrats, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, former Congresswoman Gwen Graham, and Winter Park businessman Chris King, have struggled to raise the kind of cash it'll take to win a crowded primary. On the Republican side, Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam from Bartow raised $1.1 million for both his campaign and his political committee last month, and that was more than double the $529,000 combined total taken in by Democrats Graham, Gillum, and King. And State Senator Jack Latvala, a Republican from Clearwater, who declared his candidacy in August, raised a whopping $824,000 in September alone.
Souza, why is Levine getting in the race?
Because he wants to, right? He's been a successful mayor in Miami Beach. He is able to self-fund his campaign. He resonates well with voters in a Democratic primary. He's a strong environmental candidate. Voters on both sides, definitely Democrats, but Florida voters care about environmental issues, and so he has every reason to believe that he can be competitive.
Is this what the Democrats need, a self-funder?
It doesn't ever hurt, right? It doesn't hurt to start with some money.
Wendy, I want to ask you about our friend Adam Goodman, who's a media guy. There was some talk that Goodman, who was a Republican, might cross over and work for Levine in this race. What do you know about that?
Well, Adam told me in January that he would like to. Adam and Levine are best friends. They have been for years. He worked on Levine's 2013 nonpartisan mayor's race. He has also worked for other Democrats, including Bob Buckhorn, but only in nonpartisan races. This would have been a move to have Adam, who's a nationally known as a Republican media maven, working for a Democrat in a partisan race, and that would have been a major issue. Adam told me today that he will not, in fact, be working for Levine, but he will be giving him counsel and advice on a volunteer basis. Probably, I think you can say, if he would have been a big distraction if he'd been on the campaign.
That's what I was going to ask you, April. Could a nationally prominent Republican media figure, media guru like Adam Goodman, could he work for Levine, and then could he come back and work for any other Republican down the road?
If anybody could do it, Adam Goodman probably could, but it's challenging. It poses challenges. Whenever you work as a Republican consultant, whenever you work with Democrats, it stirs up the Republican people and the powers that be and the base, and it's something they really don't like. So it could cause some, you know, damage to your future and potential earnings and those sorts of things. But I truly believe that if anybody could pull it off, it could be Adam.
You could finesse it.
So
Levine's biggest nightmare, two words, John Morgan. I think Morgan, if he decides to get in, and I think he will, I think is the hands-on favorite to win the Democratic nomination.
Another guy who could self-fund.
That's right. Yeah. He can absolutely.
And Levine has said that he will go up to $20-25 million of his own money into this race. But it's interesting to me is to look at how he is positioning himself very similar to Governor Scott. He's very pro-people, pro-business, jobs, 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 work, get to work, let's get to work, and a self-funder.
Self-funding isn't all there is to it.
Right.
Levine's insider allies and friends are talking up very heavily his fundraising network. He's connected to the Clintons. He's connected to the entertainment industry. They're telling me to expect him to very quickly raise more money than the rest of the Democratic field combined.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Well, before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to? And Wendy, let's start with you. Your other big story.
Well, sort of overshadowed by the other political news today, CFO Jimmy Patronis declared his intention to run for the seat that he's in now, which he was appointed to, State Chief Financial Officer. That's an issue locally because State Senator Tom Lee of Thanota-Sassa also wants to run for that office and could find himself in a primary against Petraeus, who is, of course, backed by Governor Scott.
But Lee has a pretty good statewide network.
Lee has a good statewide network. He's got almost $2 million bucks in the bank.
All right, Susan, your other big story.
Also on the ballot this Tuesday will be Penny for Pinellas. And when there's been so much media attention on the mayoral race, this is critical for Pinellas at a time when municipalities are under home rule and being attacked and losing funding. This is $2 billion spread out over 10 years for 24 municipalities. It would have a huge impact if Pinellas were to lose it.
Okay. Mike, your other big story.
The events in New York City and the terror attack. And while the alleged terrorist, because he hasn't been convicted yet, even though he has admitted it, lived in Tampa for a time, I think that's something that takes our eye off the ball here in the Bay Area. It's sort of akin to the hijackers training in Venice for 9/11. The bigger problem is how our country copes with terrorism. And I thought the juxtaposition of the president today in two instances, when there was the Las Vegas shooting, he said, this is not the time to talk about politics. We need to grieve. Whereas today, he was talking about stopping immigration. That's one juxtaposition. The other is how George Bush handled 9/11 when he brought the country together. He even went to a mosque and said, do not blame this on Muslims. It seems to me that President Bush tried to bring us together. President Trump is trying to divide us because that's the way he operates. But this is a grave incident, the biggest attack in New York City since 9/11. I'm amazed it hasn't happened before. And I think with these wildcat terrorists, we're going to see more of this. And it's not because of immigration, but it's because of people that just are fanatics and believe in the cause of ISIS.
Lone wolf, self-radicalization. April, your other big story.
Well, today was the deadline of the Constitutional Revision Commission to get in all of their ideas and to begin working on it, solidify it. They have over 64 possibilities for amendments to our Constitution, including banning the death penalty, restoring voters' rights for felons, and going back to what the voters had rejected some time ago, an elected Secretary of State joining the cabinet.
How many of those do you think will survive and actually get on the ballot?
Hopefully not nearly that many, because the ballot could be baffling. But no, I'm sure it'll be narrowed down quite a bit. I can't imagine how many will actually come out of there and go onto the ballot.
Lots of interesting ideas, though.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you all for showing up, and what a great show this was. And thanks for watching Florida This Week.
That was Florida This Week, which is a television program that airs on WEDU-TV on Friday nights at 8:30 and also Sunday afternoons at 12:30, just before the football games start. And my guests on that show, Mike Deason and William March, they were the journalists on that panel. April Schiff was the Republican, and Susan McGrath was the Democrat. And among the things we talked about, of course, the St. Pete mayor's race and also the growing sex scandal involving members of the legislature, including Jack Latvala, who is running for governor. And there's an update to that. We didn't get to it on the show because the show was recorded very early last week. But I'm going to read something from Politico about the senator from Clearwater that's very interesting. And if you want to comment about anything you've heard here the past 25 minutes or so, you can call us up at 813-239-9663, and we can talk about it if there's an issue that you want to bring up or respond to. And again, that number is 813-239-9663. Well, the update to the Jack Latvala story and the story about spying in Tallahassee against members of the legislature, there was an update written on the Politico website. And the headline says, six women accuse Florida Senate Budget Chair Jack Latvala of groping sexual harassment. And the story says this, six women who work in Florida's Capitol say the state Senate's powerful budget chairman, Republican gubernatorial candidate Jack Latvala, has inappropriately touched them without their consent or uttered demeaning remarks about their bodies. Women who include Senate staff and lobbyists affiliated with both major parties told Politico Florida that they did not want to be identified for fear of losing their jobs, getting a bad reputation in the male-dominated Capitol, or running afoul of an influential politician who can kill their clients' issues. The incidents, they said, occurred over a period of several years, happening in the privacy of Latvala's Senate office or in public places like the Capitol Rotunda or a bar or an elevator. Latvala has denied ever sexually harassing anyone, and when asked a general question by a reporter on Thursday about whether sexual harassment is a problem in the Florida Senate, said he's never even been formally accused of it. After Latvala made his remarks, five of the six women decided to speak with Politico Florida to say that they were harassed. Five said the harassment was physical. One woman, a Republican Senate staffer who spoke to Politico Florida earlier this week, cried in recounting her story. Latvala, in an interview on Friday with Politico Florida, pointed to the fact that in 16 years in the Senate, he has never had a complaint filed against him. "The Senate provided you with a letter that I have never had a complaint filed against me in 16 years, said Latvala. "I'm sure you have handpicked people and you're going to let anonymous people have this kind of impact on the career of a guy who's been there for 16 years, he said. "I've never had a complaint filed against me. Govern yourself accordingly," he told a Florida Politico reporter. Known in the state capitol for associating with a bevy of young female lobbyists in his office and at bars and restaurants, Latvala, who is married, was under surveillance last spring by an undercover private investigator who snapped a photo of him kissing a lobbyist on the lips in the public. In that case, Latvala and the lobbyist said the kissing was innocent and consensual. And the Politico story goes on to say, but women who spoke to Politico Florida described their physical interactions with Latvala as anything but welcomed. They said that they felt degraded and demeaned when he touched their buttocks or other private areas of their body, or when he commented on their weight or their breast size. One woman said the legislator would audibly grunt in her ear when giving her lengthy hugs that were physically and emotionally painful and embarrassing. The story goes on to say, you don't force your kids to hug relatives and kiss relatives, and this is why, said one of the women, a fellow Republican who has worked with Latvala in the Florida Senate during the interview. There are other senators, male and female, who I hug and kiss on the cheek on a regular basis, but they've never touched the places on my body where only my bikini touches. Several of the women interviewed said that when lobbying Latvala, they understood that their issues would be viewed more favorably if they were willing to at least flirt with him. Even those who were not directly touched by Latvala, speaking of a cold shoulder, if they didn't play along or appeared to be prudes, they had to grin and bear it, said one longtime lobbyist who works for a Republican-led firm. It was so disgusting, and I just had to stand there over and over again when he would do this, squeezing me hard and grunting in my ear, she said. The question isn't whether this happened to me. The question is who this didn't happen to in the Capitol. It's not like it's a secret that Jack is like this. Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz, who represents the panhandle in the Florida House for three terms from, or represented rather, the panhandle in the Florida House for three terms from 2010 to 2016 before being elected to Congress, worked alongside Latvala in the Florida legislature and says he was known to be an absolute hound in the Capitol. He's a hound. I mean, everyone in Tallahassee knows that Jack Latvala is an absolute hound, said Gaetz, the son of former Florida Senate President Don Gaetz. Jack believes that his power as a legislator gives him some special power with women, and there are times when it's clearly unrequited. Well, that's just a partial reading of the Politico story that came out over the weekend. Headline: six women accuse Florida Senate Budget Chair Jack Latvala of Clearwater of groping and sexual harassment. So you can read it at politico.com. Politico is spelled P-O-L-I-T-I-C-O. So, okay, 813-239-9663, our email address, dj@wmnf.org. There's more news I want to bring up, but let's take a phone call right now. We're going to go to Adam, who's in Tampa. Adam, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind today?
I was listening to one of your segments earlier, and they were talking about the fanaticism of the terrorist attack in New York City. And I think one of the things that gets lost in the analysis of this is when looking at the behavior of the individuals, everybody wants to rush and say that they're fanatic. ISIS basically brainwashed these individuals. But if you look a little bit deeper into the individual's past, he struggled with work, with employment, And what radicalizes these young individuals is this hopelessness. And I think that's what we as a country have to see, is if we're fighting an ideological battle, we're hoping that we can change minds, basically hearts and minds. And the only way to do that, really, that's going to be effective in the long term, is to turn them into advocates for our culture and not for the ISIS culture. Basically, ISIS brainwashes them and tells them they have a better life after they kill themselves or become martyrs for the cause. If you look at many of the individuals who have done these things, yes, there have been some that have been funded and are not necessarily poor, but many of them can be changed into this mindset of being a martyr for their cause when they live in war-torn countries, when they're young and they indoctrinate them in. And as a country, we can continue to battle them on that front, or we can try and change their hearts and minds. And there's plenty of literature out there. In fact, there was a story of an island just off the coast of Australia where they said, I believe it was some of the refugees who had tried to repatriate to Australia, to another island off the coast of Australia, and they were basically locked down almost like a Guantanamo, and they did a psychological study and noticed the increase in violence and definitely more disturbed behavior because of the isolation, because of the lack of jobs, because of the hopelessness. And I think we as a country have to understand that's what we're fighting. Is yes, there's going to be some martyrs and fanatics who you can't change, but what can we do to change the mindset rather than get involved in a war with bullets and guns that's just going to kill people on both sides?
Well, Adam, I think what you said is brilliant, but I would go maybe a step further and say, you know, you've got people from the Islamic faith who do this, and then you've got people who are alienated and have a sense of hopelessness who are white Americans,
right,
too. And maybe what you said not only applies to people who are relatively new to our country, but maybe it also applies to the shooter yesterday in Texas.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think this question of alienation, I think it's a huge question. It's been a question, I think, in recent years. People have turned to this kind of violence. But you're right. I think solving that problem of alienation, I mean, to the Muslim community, I think, you know, it's too bad we don't have like a TV show devoted to all the doctors, engineers, scholars, successful business people, people who are of the Muslim faith or have immigrated here from Muslim countries who succeed wildly here in the U.S. and have great lives here and really enjoy the country. I mean, we almost never see those kind of interviews. I agree with 100% on what you said.
Well, I think Trump, I think Trump divides. And as you said earlier, his kind of doctrine is to walk down the path of a more divisive country and not bring people together. And that's never going to solve our problems. And when you look at the Middle East, they've had fights for many years. But when you bring these Muslim cultures over, that's really, they have to integrate. And if you isolate them, if you make it more hopeless, we're going to get more radical, not less.
Yeah, I agree. But yet at the same time, you know, some of the top doctors, some of the top engineers here in Florida are of the Muslim faith who have emigrated here. And we don't know that as Americans. You know, unless you're in the Muslim community, unless you work shoulder to shoulder with those doctors and engineers, the media does a very poor job of explaining this.
Well, and I'm a physician myself, and so I know exactly what you're talking about. I work with those individuals on a regular basis, and they are articulate, hardworking. They want to be a part of our culture. And anybody who's given that chance and a hope to build a life won't radicalize themselves because they have too much to lose. But when you have a hopeless generation, whether they be immigrants or people who live here, you're going to create radicals because they don't see a way out.
Well, Adam, what you said is brilliant. I'm glad you called.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. All right. 813-239-9663. I just want to give a quick update about the tragedy yesterday in Texas. This is the latest that we've got from the Associated Press. Authorities believe the man suspected of killing 26 people and injuring about 20 others at a Texas church shot himself following a car wreck yesterday. Wilson County Sheriff Joe D. Tackett Jr. tells CBS News that police found Devin Patrick Kelly dead inside his vehicle Sunday shortly after the shootings in Sutherland Springs. Tackett says Kelly was being pursued by two community members, and investigators believe gunfire was exchanged before Kelly's vehicle crashed. The sheriff said investigators believe Kelly shot himself after the wreck. So that's the latest news. We're going to hear more about that at the top of the hour when we get the NPR news. And again, if you want to comment, call us up, 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. Sean Canaan has another fascinating program coming up at noon today. He'll be talking about the deep divisions in the Libertarian Party. The Libertarian Party as a party and then as a faction within the Republican Party is a growing movement in this country. But there is a former Libertarian leader who has a very strong warning for all of us about what's going on inside the Libertarian Party. So you want to stick around for that. It's going to be a good show at 12 noon, as it always is. Let's go to Gary in Dunedin. Hi, Gary. You're on WMNF. What would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. Two topics. You know, if the Politico article is correct, I guess we could say that Latvala is like almost a Harvey Weinstein of the Florida legislature, and it's sad that if his colleagues knew that he was like this and that the culture of the male-dominated legislature is so corrupted that, quote, everybody knew for years he was a hound, but nobody did anything. That's just... it's sickening, and it goes to the Texas thing. I read, and my jaw dropped open on Huffington Post when the guy's neighbors, the shooter's neighbors, just said, yeah, he was a regular nice guy. Oh, sometimes we heard lots of gunfire, even automatic weapon fire coming from over at his place, so even at night. But, hey, we didn't think anything of it because we're out here in the country. It's like, how normalized are guns, gun nuts, and gun violence that neighbors of people who are seeming like they might be preparing for some kind of terrible siege are just thought of as normal folks, even though they're firing automatic weapons at night. That's what this country has become. And as with the Vegas shooter, how do you check into a hotel with an arsenal and nobody notices? Until we get to the point where we say that guns are bad technology, and that people who are super attracted to guns and putting their guns on Facebook and fondling them ought to be looked into by law enforcement and mental health professionals proactively, we're going to keep having these insane things happen.
Yeah, the number seems to be growing, too, doesn't it?
It's insane.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, a guy can rent a truck and do something terrible, too, but guns are just, they're only good for one thing. A truck can be rented and used to help you move. But a gun is only good for killing, like that old Lynyrd Skynyrd song, Saturday Night Special. It's not good except for putting a man 6 feet in a hole. And people who are attracted to guns enough to talk about them a lot, buy a lot of them, fetishize them, go to shows, and otherwise fondle them, why are their neighbors not saying, Sheriff, I don't know if there's anything going on here, but my neighbor is firing automatic weapons at night. You might want to check into him.
Especially since he's been convicted of domestic abuse.
Yeah, in a rural, and they kept emphasizing in all the coverage, this is a rural community, everybody knows each other. Well, if they knew that he was already a dangerous, violent guy who had been dishonorably discharged from the military and was known for beating, you know, the most innocent and sweet person in his life, which was his spouse, the mother of his child, then why didn't anybody intervene? They all just like go, well, he's got a bunch of guns and he shoots them at night, but la, la, la. And then when something horrible happens with this guy, they all go, we never would have suspected it.
Yeah. Gary, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right. So a lot of people commenting about Texas. Let's go to, we're going to go to Jim in Tampa first, and we go to Gene in Dunedin, and we've got several other callers, too, that we'll get to in just a moment. Let's go to Jim first. Hi, Jim, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi, Rob. I just want to let you know that your point about the fact that members of the Islamic faith are really major contributors to our society. My dentist is an Iranian immigrant, and he's created a wonderful life. He's employed about a dozen people, and everybody's doing well, and he's safe to keep. So that's one thing.
That's really important.
Then on the policy level, who do you think staffs the universities in engineering?
I think there's a lot of people from the Middle East are staffing a lot of the engineering jobs at the university. What do you think?
Absolutely. They're staffing engineering, science, mathematics, all the things that we depend on to be a world-class society. If it weren't for those people who are willing to come over here and sacrifice 8 or 10 years getting a PhD so they can teach the ungrateful sons of riches, we'd be really in rough shape.
Yeah, I agree. The contribution is huge, and it's really unseen for the most part.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Jim, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Let's go to Gene in Dunedin, then we'll go to Glenn in Clearwater. Gene, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi, Rob.
Hi.
Thank you so much. Well, I do believe, I come from a Buddhist background, of course, where we believe in peace, and we realize that war is never going to solve our problem. And like a couple of your callers have mentioned, there are so many people that are isolated and disenfranchised and suffering. And I think it really takes one-on-one dialogue with people to really influence them, like your other caller mentioned about having them influenced by our culture rather than, you know, some of the negativity in their lives. So I was just thinking the other day about, you know, how we're having the new technology coming out with self-driving cars in the future. And we're not going to need as many police officers on the road with traffic violations and that kind of thing. And, of course, that's getting to be too dangerous nowadays anyway to chase down somebody and pull them over and they have a gun. It's just too dangerous. So I was talking to some police officers yesterday, actually, and I said, how about if you guys don't all have to be on the road doing traffic stuff, maybe we can utilize your numbers and reach out to people in their neighborhood. Go, you know, week by week, day by day, into the neighborhood and sit down with people in their homes and talk to them. And then you can find out what's going on and who needs help and connect them with local resources. And then continue to dialogue and follow up. That was just one idea I had, and I actually, you know, emailed Barack Obama to talk to him about it.
And in some ways, though, that would change the nature of police officers. Instead of being on the lookout always for bad guys or for breakers of the law, this would be their job would turn into helping link people to the community. And I know some police officers do this on their own, but it's not part, you know, it's not in their job description. There are police officers, I think, who are good sometimes that help the homeless and help others.
Right.
But this would be really going out and trying to connect people to either the education needs that they have or connect people to social service agencies. That would almost, you'd almost create a different kind of job.
Well, it would be more along the lines of social work. And
yeah.
I know they do. They have a lot of employees that do that type of work already. But they might have great numbers of people that could get out into the community in a positive note, because we tend to treat people as numbers and groups. But each person is a human being and they need connection. So I just thought it was
I think people are growing more and more disconnected just because of the nature of our society. You talk about the possibility of having driverless cars, and I think that's worth a whole show or maybe 50 shows as we get closer to that. but I think as you know, I was talking to a friend over the weekend. He sits at home and orders everything on Amazon. I was making fun of him, and we had a great conversation about it. But you know, if you sit at home and order everything on Amazon, you're no longer interacting with society. You're interacting with the UPS guy and the letter carrier, maybe,
right.
But you're not really out there in society. So we might all be headed in that direction if we are isolated in our homes and just shopping online.
That's a good point. Yeah, and that breeds more isolation.
Exactly.
And more
yeah.
Well,
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gene. Good to hear from you. All right, take care. Just want to read some emails. Here's an email from Bowen. Says, regarding the conversation on Florida this week about the huge amounts of money being raised by Republicans for the governor's race. Bowen writes, shut down funding and make the candidates earn your votes with their platform. This is obscene. The money could be better spent helping society. God forbid we think of our fellow man, writes Bowen. And Tommy writes this, I propose a ban on white Texans from the rest of the country. They are an inherent danger to the public and are known to be secessionist. So Tommy turning around the idea of a Muslim ban and saying now he wants a ban on Texans. All right, Tommy, thanks a lot. I like it. 813-239-9663, only for its illustrative purposes. And Frank Knox is our phone producer today, doing a great job. We're going to go to, let's go to Glenn in Clearwater's Promise, then we'll go to John in Largo, then John in St. Petersburg. Glenn, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hello. Thanks for your program. I have two quick comments about the shooting in Texas. You know, like I hear so often from government employees here in Pinellas County, you got to remember, they say, when they're sympathetic to my complaint, this is Florida. And Florida, like Texas, and I think Arizona, maybe one or two or three other states, have these very liberal gun ownership laws where you can pick up guns pretty much almost in the neighborhood from the local gun shop. But what I really wanted to call about was the discussion of the Pennies for Pinellas referendum that's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of two minds about this thing. On the one hand, yes, money is necessary to do things that are necessary for the infrastructure. But what I discovered in this past year is that there is no enforcement of adherence by municipalities to use the money in compliance with state law. That is, for improvement of the infrastructure and public facility. Once the municipality in all the counties in Florida, say maybe two or three, I think Broward and Plum are two of the counties that have empowered their county inspector general to keep an eye on the municipalities and make sure that they use the money in compliance with that statute contained in Article 14, state law. But without that kind of enforcement clause and without the empowerment of our local inspector general, once that tranche of money is distributed to the municipality that is derived from the sales tax surcharge called pennies from Pinellas locally, the municipalities can do whatever they want despite
so Glenn,
in order to qualify for that tranche of money.
Glenn, I want to try to hurry you up just a little bit. Could you give us an example, just a quick example of how Pinellas County misspends the money? If you think
Pinellas County.
I'm sorry?
I'm talking about the municipalities that receive.
Okay, I'm sorry. Give us an example of St. Petersburg or Clearwater or, you know, Reddington Shores. And, you know.
What caught my attention last year was the listing of the projected plan of how Clearwater was to use these monies, and they listed $12 or $13 million total for repair and renovations to two branch libraries, East and Countryside, so-called branch libraries.
All right, so is that a violation of state law?
The money for repair and renovations. They abandoned the two buildings and built completely new buildings. And
okay.
The result will be a reduction in the total library resources, which, after all, at least in this county, libraries are the most important cultural resource available to the public.
Yeah, I think the library system over there is really good. Well, Glenn, we'll have to look into it. We're out of time, practically. I want to try to squeeze in two more callers, but we'll have to look into it because I don't know enough about it. And, you know, we'll see how the vote goes tomorrow.
Thank you for your excellent program.
All right. Thanks, Glenn. Right. Good to hear from you. I gotta say, I don't know, but I will begin to look into it. Let's go to John in St. Petersburg. Hey, John, you're on. What would you like to say?
Hi. Again, on Florida This Week, you mentioned the death penalty. There's a chance for us to abolish it if it makes it on the constitutional amendment ballot. This Wednesday, Governor Scott is going to kill another human being, and I don't have a lot of time, so I want to encourage people to contact him and urge him not to do that. And if they want information on the death penalty or contact information, they can go to fadp.org, that's Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.org, fadp.org. This is an extremely expensive practice if you're trying with conservatives. $17,000 to keep a person in prison for a year, $1 million a week on the death penalty. It's not, and it doesn't reduce the murder rate. And if, please contact the governor. We need to keep this in front of the people's attention because it just sort of gets, oh dear, another execution. We need to act now so we can remove this horrific practice from our state.
All right, John, thanks a lot. Thanks for saying that. And let's try to squeeze in John in Largo. John, we only have 20 seconds. What would you like to say?
Hey, talking about the guns, 70% of the people in the United States are for guns, not gun control. And gun control is like prohibition. It's not going to work. We can't control it. It's crazy.
All right. Hey, John.
I think we got
to. John, I'm going to try to do at least a half a show this week about guns. So let's talk about it then, okay?
All right, buddy.
All right. Thanks, John. Good to hear from you. If you want to comment about anything you've heard here for the past hour, call us up, 813-238-8001, and record a comment on extension 115. And then I'll play that comment back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Sean Canaan. This is WMNF Tampa.